It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps, and today we're going to talk with musicians about how to break the rules.
You know, a lot of people think Wendell Patchick is my actual name, like a regular name. It's not. My earliest musical memory is actually from when I was 3. A cousin sat down at the piano that we had at the house and played The Entertainer by Scott Joplin. When she finished, I walked over to the piano and I started doing something on the keys. So I used to play a lot of Chopin, Rachmaninoff, Scarlatti. In my spare time, when I wasn't practicing the piano, I started to dabble in producing other kinds of music other than classical music. I bought myself a little sampler, another little drum machine, and a 4-track recorder, and just started recording little ideas, little thoughts. I started to play the music for people. They'd listen for 15, 20 seconds, and they'd sort of have sort of like a confused look on their face, and then they'd say, "Oh, where's the piano?" I felt like they were missing like the first 30 seconds just because they were associating it with what they already knew. So I thought, well, if I have a different name, it would be helpful in terms of keeping the two things separate. So I was born a twin. My twin brother did not survive the birth. His name was Wendell Patchick Gift. And my name is Kevin Gift. So I took his first name and middle name, Wendell Patchick. It just made so much sense. It's the closest thing to me. It essentially is me.
Today, Kevin Gift is an acclaimed classical pianist. Wendell Patchick is a rising hip-hop artist. And a lot of people have no idea they're the same man. Did you always know that you'd had a twin?
Oddly enough, I did. I remember asking my mother when I was 4 years old if I was a twin.
Why would you ask?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. One was just a feeling that I had. It's actually this recurring dream. I have very clear memories from when I was definitely 2, probably 1.
Wow.
And I've had that memory of that dream since before any of my other memories. In the dream, there was no sort of discernible human landmarks. There's no places. There's no people. I was present. I knew that my being was there. My consciousness was there. And there was something else that was there, or someone else that was there. Almost like this pulsing, like throbbing sound, and it would accelerate and continue to accelerate, and then it would stop, and then I just sort of had this sense that I was by myself. And I wasn't scared. There was nothing scary about the dream. And I told my mom about the dream.
My God.
When I was about 3 years old. And I just remember she sort of looked at me and smiled and then didn't really say much. I remember asking her the next year, "Mom, am I a twin?" And she started crying and she said, "Yes." You know, she explained it as best she could to a 4-year-old child.
Wow. That's amazing. Mm-hmm. It's really sad. Is it sad to you?
I lost my mother in 2017, a couple of years ago. And
I'm sorry.
Oh, thank you. And, you know, the grief surrounding that and the sadness was, you know, definitely intense and continues to be. But that is evidence and a sign of how much love I received from her and also the connection that we had. I never had that with my brother. So it's more you know, when I was younger, when I was a kid, it was more of sort of like a wistfulness, you know, sort of wondering what it would be like to have a twin.
Mm-hmm.
Or other people would say, gosh, if there were two of you, you know, that'd be crazy. Or people sometimes would say, it just seems like he's here. He's here with you. Or, you know, even before I started to use the name, folks would say, it just seems like he's looking out for you. Or, I'm not really a superstitious person, but I definitely have thought might be the case.
It seems like by choosing his name for one whole half of your musical life, it seems like giving part of your life to him, inviting him in.
I would agree with that. You know, there's all sorts of ways in which using that name has affected me that I did not anticipate at all.
Like what?
I have very good friends who don't even know that I have another name that's Kevin Gift.
Really?
Oh, yeah. And vice versa.
Even though Kevin's your legal name.
Even though Kevin's my legal name. Yeah. And I forget that that's the case because I just, this doesn't really happen anymore because it happened before. I've been booked for engagements and I won't be able to check into a hotel because I don't have an ID that says Wendell Patrick, for example. So I'll have to start pulling out magazine articles and newspaper articles and internet content and saying, oh, you know, this is me.
Do they feel like two different personalities?
So here comes my British accent. Okay, so how can I answer this best? There was a point probably maybe 6 years ago where I was at a park with my dog and there was a woman there with her dog and, you know, we just struck up a conversation, spoke for about 20 minutes and, you know, we were saying goodbye and she says, what's your name? And I just froze. I just didn't, I didn't know what to say. And she gave me this really weird look, understandably, who doesn't know their name? So I guess to answer your question, I don't feel that they're different, but there's definitely, I think, a different energy that comes from other people with regards to the two names. I remember, and maybe this speaks to the energy of the names, like I remember who I met as what.
Really?
Yeah, really, every single person. Mm-hmm.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I mean, I think it's probably a little bit like tasting food or traveling somewhere for the first time.
Hmm.
There's a definite mental imprint. And what's also interesting is I have people that knew me as Kevin while sort of my Wendell Patrick career was starting, and they all call me Kevin, but in public in certain settings, they automatically switch to Wendell. They don't even think about it.
We're talking just about the names, but the names are connected to musical identities. Just as a name kind of puts us in a box, music genres do the same thing, right? So we call something hip-hop as opposed to classical. So I'm wondering how that's worked, developing these two different musical identities and keeping them under different names. Like, does Kevin's music influence Wendell's and vice versa, or am I making a false distinction?
Well, it would be easy to perceive it that way, that Kevin's music influences Wendell and vice versa, but I teach at Peabody Conservatory and Johns Hopkins, and I tell my students that it's always about pitch and rhythm and how you use those things. You can organize those things in such a way where you make classical music, or in such a way where you make hip hop, or in such a way where you make anything, really.
Who am I? I part of the Red Sea. Led Moses and his followers behind me. I wrote 12 commandments, dropped 2, climbing up the mountain. The other 10 had enough about him for all of y'all to get the picture.
Are you making an argument for us breaking down some of those genres, those barriers between music? Should we just think of it all as music?
No, I don't think so at all. I'll give you another example. One thing that I'll ask my students is I'll say, you know, if you have a bicycle and you take the handlebars off, what do you have? And they'll all say, a bicycle with no handlebars. And I say, all right, if you take the seat off, now what do you have? And they'll say, a bicycle with no handlebars and no seat. And then if you keep going, at some point, somebody's going to say, you have a bicycle frame. They're not going to say, you have a bicycle without handlebars, a seat, brakes, wheels. They don't. At some point, it switches to this other thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't keep going, but you could, right? You could say, well, okay, if you melt that bicycle frame down. No one's going to say it's a bicycle frame with no handlebars, no seat, no wheels that was then melted down. And so I think that the genres of music, not necessarily named genres, but I'd say the differences in styles of music are beautiful, hugely important, and often tied to a deep and rich cultural history of some kind.
Are there any places where you bring your two musical identities together?
Well, definitely with the Out of the Blocks podcast and radio show that I create with Aaron Henkin. That's an amazing playground for me. You know, on Out of the Blocks, I can write something that sounds like a full classical orchestra, and then the very next thing have it something that's got banging 808s on it and scratching. That is certainly something that I could put on an album that I put out, but I think the public is so accustomed to buying or consuming music as it pertains to whatever dividing factors exist without even really knowing that that's the case. I think we do like to consume music in the way we like to consume a lot of things. I mean, if I go out to eat Thai food, I probably don't want a burger with it, you know, and that's fine.
There's a really great Korean-Mexican place down the block from me. But I know what you mean. So are there nights when you've gone to some town to play and like you're performing one night as Kevin and the next night as Wendell?
No, but I'm sure that'll happen. I'm sure that'll happen.
When you go to Starbucks and they ask you what name you want on the cup, do you always know?
No, I don't. I don't. Sometimes I say Kevin, sometimes I say Wendell. And when I meet someone for the first time, sometimes I say Kevin, sometimes I say Wendell.
How do you decide?
I don't know. Just whatever I'm feeling at that particular moment, I suppose.
Huh.
Yeah.
I still don't get it. I want to understand, because it sounds like there's a mood that goes with Wendell and there's a mood that goes with Kevin. Is that wrong?
It's the same mood. I mean, honestly, when I meet someone for the first time and I tell them my name, I really feel the way I've always felt when I just felt I had a twin. I just feel like, you know, there's one person that just has two. It's like a left and a right side, I guess.
Do you feel like you're keeping him alive?
No, I don't. I mean, I think he passed away. I mean, I know he passed away. But, you know, so for example, I have his birth certificate. And both of our birth certificates have the same time on them. That doesn't make any sense.
So you don't know which of you was born first?
Don't know which of us was born first. I know my mother told me that she knew she had twins, and it was a complicated birth. She almost died. And she told me that when she asked the doctor, where's the other one? They said, oh, he's resting. You know, he's resting. But that she was then told that he had passed away, and she was also, I think, medicated at the time. And so, yeah, I don't feel like I'm keeping him alive, but that feeling that has always been there from when I was one or two or whenever, I don't think I'm keeping that alive. I think that's just...
Yeah.
I think that exists. It just exists, if that makes sense.
It does. And I mean, I also think, to a certain extent, we've all created a fiction that we walk around with in some ways, this idea that I am one person with one name.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just a convention. I mean, you can imagine living in a culture in which everybody used more than one name, or living in a culture in which we thought of ourselves as having more than one personality.
Honestly, we're not, none of us are one person with one name. I would say we're actually all one person with no name. Again, we don't have a name. That name is given to us. Most of us aren't cognizant enough to remember bonding with our name, right?
Right.
I think most parents, when they name their kids, they do it with intention. But the name takes on a whole other meaning to the individual that has nothing to do with their parents.
No, it's like a suit of clothes.
Yep.
It's an empty suit of clothes, and we have a lifetime to fill it.
Right.
Have you ever thought about giving one of the names up?
Which one? I mean, no. I don't think I can.
Kevin Gift has toured the world as a classical pianist. He teaches at Loyola University, Maryland. Wendell Patrick is the hip-hop artist and sound designer for the award-winning podcast Out of the Blocks, and he teaches at the Peabody Music Conservatory. You can discover all his music via our website. That's ttbook.org. What does it take to cross musical borders effortlessly? To speak multiple musical languages fluently? Avant-garde composer Philip Glass told Steve Paulson that his own music changed when he began studying other cultures.
I found that my encounters with the non-Western music, the more non-Western it was, the more impact the encounters had on me.
Why was that?
Because it was so new to me. It was something I didn't know. When I was working with Mark Atkins, a didgeridoo player from Australia, and a wonderful player, I said to Mark, I asked him the same question that I asked myself. I said, Mark, where does the music come from? Isn't that nice? and this is what he said. He said, well, I think of this kangaroo. I'm out in the bush, and I see the kangaroo running across the field, and I bring the didgeridoo up to my lips, and that's the music I play. With Ravi Shankar, I was a very young man. I was maybe 26 or 27. I was sitting with him in his hotel room. And I said to him, Raviji, where does music come from? And this is what he did. He was sitting on his bed and, you know, cross-legged on the bed. I was sitting in the chair near the night table. And he turned to a picture, a photograph of an Indian man dressed in kind of a Nehru kind of coat, you know. And he bowed to full prostration in front of the picture and he said, thanks to the grace of my guru, the music has come from him into me.
Wow.
So that's it. Those are powerful questions. And
yeah.
I had the great good fortune of being with people like that.
Yeah.
I'd say most of my life.
That's an excerpt from a longer conversation between Steve Paulson and the avant-garde composer Philip Glass. If you want to hear the whole thing, it's online at ttbook.org. Coming up, a jazz piano player who mixes rock and roll, R&B, and hip-hop. And speaking of hip-hop, we'll also wrap with the U.S. State Department's first-ever hip-hop ambassador. I'm Ann Strangechamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio. And PRX. We'll be right back. I listen to a lot of jazz, which I think of as the original Crossroads music. Improvisation is its DNA. Jazz artists have always borrowed bits and pieces from other music genres and then remade them into something new. Case in point, Robert Glasper, the Grammy Award-winning jazz pianist. A few years back, he started messing around in the worlds of R&B, hip-hop, even rock and roll. His experiments turned into an album called Black Radio, which is really almost impossible to categorize. He told Steve Paulson there's a simple explanation.
I just do what I like to do, and I love jazz, and I'm a jazz pianist, and then I also love R&B and hip-hop, which, you know, that's my whole thing. I've always been in both sides of that world. You know, I'm a Blue Note recording artist, and I've, you know, played in Christian McBride's band and Kenny Garrett's band and Russell Malone and Roy Hargrove and Terrence Blanchard. And, but at the same time, I'm also Maxwell's piano player and recorded and played with Q-Tip, and I'm Mos Def's music director. You know, and I do that side too. So I just love music. So I put together a record that I think is just good music. And lo and behold, it debuted at number 4 on the hip-hop R&B charts, right after Rihanna. And that doesn't happen. So I was number 1 on the jazz charts and number 4 on hip-hop R&B charts. So my point was to cross over, you know what I mean, in doing this record, doing a record that kind of flirts with a lot of different styles. But it also did it on Billboard as well, to my surprise.
Of a man's soul, or Ninja Turtles pouring out of manholes. It's this balance between the comic and the conscious that's the challenge, between the solitary and the conference that I examines, that I imagine once a figure will be the start of world peace and the transformation into again, like the transubstantiation of liquor, but that's just turning them into blood, and we'll be right back where we was, not a peace sign but a fascination with scissors, so I can cut myself off from the calculations of empress empires and the centers for advancement and human suffering and other things trying to impede my publishing.
I just want to be, I just want to be. Some people in the jazz world are probably saying, oh, he's sold out or something. You're selling out, you're doing this hip-hop stuff. But actually, I'm being honest. I'm of the hip-hop generation, so I'm doing what's in within my generation. So actually, I'm not selling out, I'm being honest. Me not being honest would be selling out.
I have to ask about this crossover because, I mean, this is a fascinating collection of music that you're drawing from on this album. I mean, you have David Bowie tunes, Nirvana, as well as the classic jazz standard Afro Blue. I mean, it raises the question, what holds all this music together?
I mean, the honest love for it, for me. I mean, I grew up, my mother was a singer, piano player, and she listened to so much music, all kinds of different music, you know. From, I mean, you could walk in the house, one minute you're listening to Liza Minnelli, the next minute you're listening to Ella Fitzgerald and Oscar Peterson, then you're listening to Mahalia Jackson, then you're listening to Phil Collins or Billy Joel and Bruce Hornsby. The list just goes on and on. So I've always been a fan of just all kinds of music. I think what holds it together is having a band that also has that same eclectic taste in music and who can also play all that kind of stuff in a fashion that's comfortable and effortless. So it brings everything across in a very honest and effortless and casual way versus it sounding like we're trying to be cool by doing these songs. When in fact, I've loved Nirvana since I was in sixth grade. You know what I mean? I've loved Teen Spirit, that specific song, Smells Like Teen Spirit, for that long as well. You know what I mean? So it's just, I'm just really being honest of what I like. It's just that, you know, people don't expect you to like certain things, you know, I guess.
So how would you describe your version? Is this jazz? Is this rock?
It's a bunch of stuff in one. I think it's a more laid-back urban approach, especially towards the end. It gets there. It turns into more of an R&B slow jam out of nowhere, which I love because it literally comes out of nowhere. And it wasn't even planned that way. We just kind of happened that way. And Layla just happened to be in the studio while we were recording that song. So I was like, hey, come sing on it. You know what I mean? So I feel like, yeah, it's just it's the urban version of Teen Spirit, speaking to everyone, just like the original was, just in a different way that everybody can hear it.
What is it about the way jazz is usually played that you don't like then? I mean, do you feel like it's too stuck in the past?
Way too stuck in the past. It's when you listen to a lot of jazz nowadays, they're drawing from 1960 and before. They make that their whole thing. And the thing that's different is those cats weren't doing that. The cats in 1960 were not drawing from, you know, 80 years before them. You know what I mean? They were playing what was fresh, cool, and hip at that moment. Like, that was the hip-hop of its day. We now are drawing from the past and kind of making the past our present in some way. And that's not what our founding fathers of the music had in mind.
Let's talk about what you do. And just to cite one example, actually, from a previous album, Mood, you have an arrangement of Herbie Hancock's Maiden Voyage, which features vocals from the hip-hop artist Bilal. And you're also sampling on piano the Radiohead song Everything in Its Right Place.
Right.
Which raises the question, what is it? I mean, is this jazz, this song? Is it hip-hop? Does it matter?
It's jazz, because jazz takes from its surroundings and makes something new. It's like a casserole. You know, they take a bunch of old things that are lying around and new things that are lying around, and you make a new meal. It's casserole. That's what, you know, John Coltrane did with My Favorite Things. Nobody listens to My Favorite Things by John Coltrane and says that's not jazz, because My Favorite Things is not a jazz tune. My Favorite Thing is a show tune. You know, that's from The Sound of Music. And he took that and was like, hey, I like that song. It's not a jazz song, but I'm going to make it into one because I like it. That's what John Coltrane did. And everyone's like praising it now. Oh my God, it's amazing. It's in all the jazz books, you know. But it takes people like that to keep jazz alive and keep it growing. You know, you have to take things that are around you and you have to tell your own story. I can't tell the story of somebody in 1950. That's why those songs don't do anything for me. I love Body and Soul. I love playing Body and Soul. It doesn't touch me like something else might that's of this generation. You know what I mean? I didn't grow up with Body and Soul. I didn't cry to Body and Soul. I didn't get my heart broken to Body and Soul. You know, and those people did.
We've been talking about some of the great singers who were featured on your album Black Radio. One of them is Erykah Badu, who sings the classic Afro Blue. Tell me about that choice.
Ever since I've heard Erykah Badu's voice, I've always thought she sounded like a reincarnated Billie Holiday. You know, she's embodied that. It's not even like she's trying. It just is. So in my mind, I've always heard her singing jazz. I've never heard her sing jazz before, but in my mind, she sings jazz all the time. So when I asked her to be on the record, and I've always loved this song, Afro Blue, and for me, her and Afro Blue go hand in hand. She even thanked me for turning her on to this song after the fact. She's like, oh my God, thank you. I love this song. I don't know why I've never heard it, you know. So when I did this arrangement, I did it specifically for her, and she loves flutes. Mm-hmm. You know, so I specifically made this arrangement just for her, and it came off so great. She's so natural. Rich as the There's a million good singers, you know. There's a million technical singers. There's a million technical piano players, you know. But who has a sound? You know, who sounds like themselves? Who has a story? Is what I'm looking for. You know what I mean? And everybody on this album has that. At the end of the day, I don't care what you're saying. If I can't listen to your voice, I don't want to hear you talk. You know, sound is the first thing you hear. It's the video audio. It's the first thing you hear is sound. Then after that. Oh, they sound, what are they saying? Oh, they can sing really good. But the first thing you hear is the sound of their voice. And everybody on this album, if they all just say, la, you know who they are.
That's jazz artist Robert Glasper talking with Steve Paulson about his Grammy Award-winning album, Black Radio. We're talking about crossing musical borders today. Hip-hop artist Toni Blackman has crossed so many and traveled so far, she ended up at the U.S. State Department as its first ever hip-hop ambassador. Here's what she sounded like live in our studio, freestyling for all you public radio listeners, with a little help from her friend, Senegalese rapper Human.
There we go, Human on the beat. Tony V on the mic, why? Fitting from the heart right now. So check this, as I be coming through with the public radio listener talking to you. So you can know as we say what we feel. The negative energy said we intend to kill. We understand how hip-hop builds. We understand how hip-hop heals. We understand how you might feel based upon the mainstream and the stories that they tell. What? But we have another side to this vision. We ask you to listen and to listen with precision. We making an incision inside of your heart. I said I improvise it right now so you could pause, so you can start right now, right here, and be clear right now, right here. Said I have no fear when I start to talk about this culture of mine. I said this hip-hop, it steadily blows my mind. I said for many, many years, I've been down, and for many, many years, I'ma stick around because I know what art can do to set us free. Because I know the purpose of art and the poetry.
Former hip-hop ambassador Toni Blackman with beatboxing support from Senegalese rapper Human. That's from a day they stopped by our studio. Of course, we did an interview too. You can hear that online at ttbook.org. Coming up later, an acclaimed cellist takes her instrument to a whole nother level. I'm Anne Strandchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. When I was 6 years old, the Monkees came out with a hit single, Last Train to Clarksville. The last train to Clarksville, and I'll meet you at the station. I thought it was the best thing that I had ever heard. My sister and I played that record practically to death. Today, okay, that's maybe a little embarrassing to admit, but that was me, age six. When Nika Costa was about the same age, she was singing with Frank Sinatra on the White House lawn. Her dad was Sinatra's arranger, and so Nika grew up with the American Songbook. And then as a teenager, she could not get far away fast enough. She became a pop sensation in Europe. She even toured with Britney Spears. And then one day, as she told Charles Monroe Kane, a chance discovery brought her back to those musical roots.
I'm gonna love you like nobody's loved you. Come rain or come shine.
I was cleaning out my office and I stumbled across, literally underneath these shelves, this huge arrangement. It said Rain or Shine, FS Reprise, Don Costa, and like the address where, you know, I grew up as a kid. And I called Jeff and I said, Jeff, you got to come over here. Like, what is this? You know, so he comes over and reads through it. We both realize that it's the actual arrangement that was on Frank's record.
Wow.
I said to Jeff, can you possibly squash this 60-piece arrangement, you know, down to our humble, you know, quartet and rhythm section. And I think he did an amazing job. And it's so special to me because it's like being with my dad for that 3 or 4 minutes each time we play it. So it's very cool.
You're gonna love me like nobody's loved me. Come rain.
Kids are really just more like, they don't really care who their parents' friends are, you know?
Right.
So my parents' friends happen to be singers and musicians and stuff, but...
I think we should interrupt just for a moment just to make sure it's very clear. Your parents' friends were Sammy Davis Jr., Frank Sinatra. Your parents' friends were some of the greatest musicians ever. Who you hung out with. Yeah.
Totally. So I'd be like, Frank, throw me in the pool. You know, like, that was pretty much... I have this photo of me when I'm about 3 and Sammy Davis Jr. and he's cracking up. So it was just, those were my folks. It was crazy. Like Sly Stone was in my living room. I always tell the story because I remember it so well. I was trying to sleep and, you know, my parents were, you know, jamming. I heard this guy, you know, outside playing piano. I was just like, ah, so aggravated. I was trying to sleep. I was probably about 6. And I just wanted to go to school the next day and just. And I run out there, and there's this guy, and he's in red spandex and a white Mickey Mouse sweatshirt and a huge afro, and he's just banging on the piano. And I'm like, hey, shut up. I'm trying to sleep. sleep. I got school tomorrow. And it was Sly Stone. So, doof. You know, had I known years later, I'd be idolizing his funk mastery.
Nika Costa, reminiscing with Charles Monroe Kane. The full interview and the in-studio performance is on our website at ttbook.org. And now for something a little more classical with a twist. This is the cellist, Clarice Jensen, warming up in our studios. She's going to be talking with Charles Monroe Kane in a minute. But before they get started, let me tell you about her. She got an early start on her instrument at age 3. She studied at Juilliard and worked her way up the classical ranks. The cello was her life for more than 30 years. And then, one day, she realized she didn't actually like the way her cello sounded anymore. And that's when Clarice Jensen decided to reinvent her instrument with guitar pedals. She built a whole new sound.
Do you hear me?
I hear you. You sound great.
Okay.
Do you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, we're so close. I think we're close to an interview. We got a cello. We got weird things plugged into the cello. Are you ready to get started?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Well, can we hear it?
Sure.
Thanks.
Yeah.
We're in a studio here. I got 3 other people sitting in front of me. And pretty much in the beginning, everybody's shutting their eyes, right? I have a light here so I can read. I'm in a studio without windows. Mm. I shut off the light. I put my feet up.
Nice.
I shut my eyes. But just like in the past with this music, I've been listening to this music a lot last couple of days. I don't find it necessarily relaxing.
Mm.
Somehow it's a little offsetting. I love putting like, I don't know, I can only think about like camping in Alaska. You're kind of having fun, but you're always afraid you're going to get killed by a bear.
Oh, wow.
The music layer in the background is 3 chords, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yes.
3 chords. That's like simple rock and roll. That's punk music. You know, that's aggression layered on top of this extreme beauty.
Yeah, it's sort of a contradiction, I guess. But I think that's pretty interesting and something I look for and... on the surface of things, your immediate read. It's major chords, it's tonal, it's easy. But I try to find ways to, just in very subtle ways, subvert that feeling of calmness and peacefulness. I'm not trying to be manipulative. I think I'm trying to kind of... I mean, I think life is like that, you know, or camping in Alaska can be, I've never camped in Alaska, but...
Well, you wouldn't like it. It's nerve-wracking. But it seems like art's not supposed to put us to sleep, right? Isn't art supposed to wake us up to something?
Absolutely.
What are you playing? Can you describe it to us?
Well, I'm playing a cello. Mm-hmm. And attached to my cello, I have a pickup. And the pickup is sending the line into a chain of pedals. First, an octaver pedal, which is... it's a pog, and it will take the sound and replicate it an octave higher or an octave lower. And then I have a couple of loopers and a delay pedal and 2 freeze pedals. And last, but most importantly, a very nice delay pedal. Sorry, no, reverb pedal. And so the reverb pedal is kind of what makes everything, stitches all the sound together and makes it sound beautiful.
I'm sure you've been playing cello since you were like a little kid.
Mm-hmm.
There must have been a time, probably alone, in your apartment in New York where you plugged the cello into an effect pedal, maybe one, and you heard that sound differently, that you've played the cello your whole life. What was that like the first time you like heard the echo?
I mean, it was pretty horrifying. I thought it sounded terrible.
Oh no.
The first pedal I had was a Boss, just a Boss looper that everybody has. And I was just like, what am I going to do with this that isn't a gimmick, basically? But it was a really important moment, though, because I finally just stopped sort of imagining what I could do and started experimenting and trying. And so, I mean, it started from a very, from a really low musical place. But the more stuff you try and the more pedals you buy and the different way you order things, and I'm reordering my pedal board all the time, so it's just sort of like a constant evolving thing about trying to find a sound and then trying to evolve that sound too, I guess.
Sounds like you're having fun.
Yeah, it's super fun.
You know, it seems to me that cello music is, especially the famous cello music, it is just steeped in tradition. You know what I mean? And like,
yes.
And I'm just like, what would Bach think of what you're doing? Not that it's any of his business, but I'm just curious what you think he would think.
I'm not really sure if he'd like it. I mean, a lot of my music is sort of durations of things. I mean, obviously I love Bach and play Bach a lot by myself, and that is sort of the most famous solo cello music that exists. I think this is kind of the polar opposite in most regards. I guess the way I like to describe it is durations of tones that are sustained for long periods of time, and tones come in above them and go away, or rhythms or rhythmic events or musical events. To me, I think the most interesting bit is that it's not subdivisions of beats that are put together to make the music, but it's more like durations of events. There's not, you know, a prescribed emotion, or there's not a purpose, or there's not a specific depiction. There may be an inspiration behind it, but I don't think that's even so relevant. It's sort of a blank canvas for the listener, you know, so you're really doing something for someone who's listening to it, as opposed to making them experience something. You're sort of inviting them to choose their own adventure or something. The effect is that it doesn't sound like a cello anymore. It's just sort of a different exploration, I guess, about how a cello can sound, you know, not like a cello.
How many years have you played the cello?
I started when I was 3.
Okay.
So 34 years.
Are you trying to get beyond the cello?
I don't know. I guess maybe since in all these 34 years of playing it, I'm just kind of tired of the sound.
Hmm.
Or I want to use it with restraint. I don't want this, just the cello sound to be the main, the sound. There's so many possibilities. It's overwhelming, you know.
Wow, that blew me away. What does it feel like for you as a performer to play that music?
Well, it definitely doesn't feel like 12 minutes. It's always a little surprising when we get to the end. It's sort of like, oh, we're already here.
That's Clarice Jensen. She's the artistic director of the American Contemporary Music Ensemble. She was in our studio talking with Charles Monroe Kane and performing pieces from her new album. It's called For This That Will Be Filled. And it's about time to wrap up. Usually I do that with credits and thank yous, and Mark Rickards would kill me if I didn't mention the website, ttbook.org. You're welcome, Mark. But instead, percussionist Dame Evelyn Glennie gets the last note today. Here she is in our studio performing a literal tiny desk concert with a tape dispenser, a box of paper clips, a piece of paper, and our engineer's keys.